Okay, good morning all. I'm speaking with Mr. Thomas Rendon. He is a longtime friend, and also we were both members of Iowa CCI. Found out that Mr. Rendon was going to the Middle East to do some work, and I was completely intrigued by it. So I thought that when he got back, it would be a good time to do a little interview and find out what was going on. So, good morning, Tom.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Oh, boy.
I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Well, let's get started right off the bat. What can you tell me about the organization that facilitated your trip? Did you just do this on your own, or how did this come about?
No, I went under the auspices of the Indiana Center for Middle East Peace.
Wow.
And I had taken a trip with them for the first time last fall to South Africa, and found it really to be fascinating. So they're kind of study tours, solidarity tours, along with plenty of sightseeing. So there's certainly a tourist in me that enjoys seeing all the great sights. And I'd never been to South Africa before, and I'd never been to Israel-Palestine either. Mm-hmm. Just a little bit about the center. The center was founded in 2004 by Dr. Michael Spath. He's also a UCC pastor, and he really set it up to be a voice of conscience for peace, justice, human rights, and intercultural understanding.
Amen.
And so he's made, like, he's been to the Middle East 40 times. This was his 19th trip. He does one every year.
Now, the group, is this a church-affiliated group? Or
Not formally. I mean, there certainly is a lot of religious content to it because he's a religious scholar. Mm-hmm. I mean he teaches world religions in Fort Wayne, Indiana. He's also he also serves as an interim pastorate to a Mennonite congregation.
Oh, wow.
south of Fort Wayne. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, most of the people that we visited are good friends of his, and they're Palestinian Christians.
Oh.
So right away, we're breaking stereotypes when a lot of people think of, you know, Palestinians as Arabs, as Muslim Arabs.
Yes,
well, there's
exactly
such a thing as Christian Arabs. In fact, there's even such a thing as Jewish Arabs, but I'm getting ahead of myself.
Okay. Did you have a perception of this place before you went? Was there a kind of a difference between what you thought it was going to be versus what it turned out to be?
I'd been following reasonably closely, you know, what had been going on there. I had an old friend who was the one who originally got me connected with the Indiana Center for Middle East Peace. He was my campus minister when I was an undergraduate at Northwestern back in the late 1970s. And he was when he reached out to me and said, "Hey, they're doing this trip to South Africa. Are you interested in going?" And since he had roped in a couple of us, he led a Bible study. But while he was doing that and performing his role as campus minister, he started to get very much interested in Middle Eastern issues and in Palestinian human rights. He was very active in the Palestine Human Rights Campaign in Chicago at the time. And even was leading a tour in Lebanon when the Israelis invaded Lebanon in 1982. So I'd been following along it off and on, and I've also had a number of good friends of mine who one is a historian and a Middle East scholar, so I followed read a lot of his books, Michael Fishbach. He's a professor, a history professor at Randolph-Macon College in Virginia.
Oh, wow.
So I would say that I probably know more than the regular person, but there were still some surprises. And that was a little bit why I kept wanting to talk to Michael. It's like, you know, Michael, you've been coming here for 20 years. What's different about our experiences?
It seems to me that people, from what I just see, you know, standard media and all that, that... that there are people there are suffering pretty immense hardships, both physical and political. What's your sense of how the spirit of the people, how do they keep going through all of this? What, again, what seems to me as an outsider seems pretty, you know, a big challenge to them.
Well, I think that's a great question, and one that I think we saw a number of different responses to. If you read the history, I mean, this stuff has been going on for since 1948 or since 1920 or 1918 or the late 19th century, or if you want to take it all the way back to, Roman Empire and Jesus's time, and or even back further. I guess one thing, particularly among the Christians that we met with, that I think keeps their hope alive, is I think a new approach to their theological thinking. And there is such a thing as Palestinian liberation theology. In wow. fact, we visited Sabeel, which is a center for Palestine liberation theology, where they're continuing to reflect and discuss and look at their situation through the eyes of the Bible, and look at the Bible through their own situation. And and what they come up with is sort of the theology. And I think it's a really natural response for any people under oppression, people of faith anyway, is to sort of say, who is God and where is God in this situation? And maybe a quick summary of where that comes from was, it was a very well-known sermon that one of the people that we met, a Lutheran pastor, Munther Isaac, who was a Lutheran pastor in Bethlehem. He's now in Ramallah. When we visited Ramallah, we had a chance to speak to him, hung out at his church for a while. But he, on the Christmas of 2023, so this is just after October 7th, like 3 months after October 7th, he preached a very powerful sermon called Christ in the Rubble. And basically in the sermon, he's going, you know, it's Christmas time. Where do we look for Jesus? We look for Jesus in the manger. And he's saying, Jesus is not in the manger. Jesus is under the rubble. And so Christ in the Rubble became, it went viral as a YouTube video. And actually he then went on to write a book called Christ in the Rubble, where he reflects on where would God be in the midst of, you know, these horrendous circumstances of Gaza. So I think trying to understand and re-understand your faith in the context of new things is certainly a source of hope and people continuing to want to move move on and to continue to believe that resistance makes sense, that resistance is still possible, that there still is something called peace and justice that we can strive for.
What are the things that people were, you know, when you said that, it instantly kind of reminded me also of the American civil rights struggle, 40s, 50s, you know, since forever, really, and my parents who were pictured up there, what they have gone through and all that. What is the kind of battery, or what are the main things that are in their reality, music or whatever? What is it that keeps them focused?
Well, I want to go back to one connection you were making between the civil rights movement,
yes,
and the Palestinian struggle, and that's actually a connection that my friend, Dr. Michael Fishbach, wrote a book about. It. It's called Black Power and Palestine, and he traces the whole connection, and it's a fascinating book for anyone interested in that connection. I can't recommend it enough. It's very readable, but he traces all of those connections, and many people had even traced it more recently to Michael Brown and some of the protests that were happening in St. Louis.
Sure.
There had been conversations between people in the Middle East who had, you know, gone through the Intifada and had all kinds of ideas about how to face armed resistance. So there was an sort of an inherent solidarity.
Yes.
And Dr. Fishbach's book traces that back even further, back to the early days of SNCC, So there was this initial sort of sympathy and understanding of what the Palestinian struggle was all about, even while, you know, a large supporter of the middle right of the civil rights movement were Jews,
yes,
in the United States. I mean, Abraham Heschel, most notably, you know, walking hand in hand with Martin Luther King in many protests.
Indeed.
And so there was a lot of solidarity between American Jews and the civil rights struggle. So this sort of added a little bit of a wrinkle to that. And
indeed,
that's a lot of what the book is about. So I just wanted to highlight that because I think it's a really interesting point to make. I think your bigger question was sort of what forms that resistance takes. And I would say that we experienced, I just saw enormous creativity. As you probably know, and people talk a lot about these big barriers, big walls that have been constructed between quote unquote Israeli parts of the West Bank and Palestinian parts of the West Bank. And these walls are just covered with all kinds of murals and protest statements. And we saw a picture of George Floyd on one of the walls, just to give you an example of the connections people were making. So there's that. People try to hang on to their culture. We visited a number of different areas where they're trying to maintain the culture of painting icons from the Orthodox tradition.
Mm-hmm.
There were examples of, there's a guy from the Ida refugee camp, which is located in Bethlehem.
Ida, how's that spelled?
A-I-D-A.
Okay.
Like the opera, only not pronounced that way.
Yes.
In there, we visited a man named Abed Absurur of the Al-Rawad Cultural Center. And he has been working on this cultural center in this refugee camp for, I think, almost 20 years.
Whoa.
And so he's built in there, like he has workshops for woodworking, for art. There's a kitchen in there. It used to run a restaurant. There was a hotel in the main facility there. And his whole vision is how to cultivate creativity as a form of resistance by holding on to the, some of the traditional arts. I mean, food is a big part of Palestinian culture, is a big part of Middle Eastern culture. And so holding on to those, just cooking those recipes and remembering how, you know, grandma used to cook it.
Amen.
And all that stuff was a way of maintaining that Palestinian identity and understanding how to resist other efforts that were trying to erase that.
That's right.
And so I found what he had to say quite moving. And it reminded me of another conversation we had with Sami Awad, a longtime nonviolent instructor, teacher, and activist, also based in Bethlehem. And I was asking him the question about, because it's something I had learned when I was in South Africa, and reading about Nelson Mandela's transition from basically a nonviolent struggle against apartheid to 1955, when he said it's too late for that. And we have to move beyond that. And part of the reason he said that was, he said, it's not fair to the people who are resisting nonviolently, who are just getting gunned down or otherwise. It's like, we're being irresponsible if we don't respond in some ways to protect our people. And so I posed that question to him because I found it very powerful, movement, because I think a lot of people have images of the ANC as being a terrorist organization. It was labeled a terrorist organization by the Reagan administration, and not to understand the evolution that took place.
Amen.
By Nelson Mandela to choose violence. And it was very, very careful, thought out. There was a lot of discussion, a lot of controversy about it within the ANC. So if you don't appreciate that story, then you really don't have a good context for the option to choose violence later on. So anyway, I was posing this to Sami, And he says something that really struck me hard. He said, well, I'll tell you something that Gandhi said, and that is, when you choose violence, it's because you've run out of creative solutions for nonviolence. And so therefore, I think any nonviolent movement has to continue to cultivate the ground out of which those creative nonviolence actions come. Mm-hmm. And this is one thing that really impressed me during my trip, was the variety of creativity and different approaches. If I can just give one example. Some people may have heard of Banksy. He's a well-known, very kind of, and a longtime supporter of Palestinian human rights from England. Anyway, he opened up a hotel in Bethlehem called, you know, in typical Banksy humor form, called the Walled Off Hotel instead of the Waldorf Hotel, yes. The Walled Off Hotel, and they sold. They sell t-shirts there that said the hotel with the worst view in the world. And the view of the world is like literally right across the street. In fact, it's not even across it. It's like halfway across the street is a huge wall. And so that's what he's meaning by the way. So you go into this hotel and it's actually a beautiful hotel, closed, by the way. And I want to get back to that later on about why it's closed. But they opened it up specially just for our group. And this is one of the advantages of going with somebody like Michael, because he knows everybody and call him and say, hey, can you do me a favor? Here, I got this group coming, you know. And so so we went in there. There's an art gallery there, all full of resistance painting. There's you can buy paintings that local artists do there. And then there's a whole museum on the resistance, on the Palestinian resistance to occupation, that also tells a very, very powerful story. And then there's all these, they had this this one exhibit in the museum of Lord Balfour, who's known for the Balfour Declaration.
Of course.
And they have him kind of on this really cheap animatronic, and he's moving his hands around in a big circle as if he's signing the Balfour Declaration. And so they're being playful, they're being mocking, they're being certainly sardonic and sarcastic, but lots of very creative approaches. There was another picture I remember they had up there, and it was the classic picture of Jesus suffering, and his eyes are looking heavenward, you know, and he just looks completely anguished. And then there's this little red laser dot on his forehead, suggesting that a sniper is in the midst. But to get back to why it's closed, the thing that people don't, I think, I certainly was surprised by, I think Michael was surprised by a little bit when we were there, was the economic strangulation that's going on.
Yes.
Bethlehem is 90% tourism. I mean, every block you drive around that city, there's a hotel. He had a favorite hotel he always stayed with, the Manger Square Hotel, closed. Every hotel was closed. He couldn't find a hotel for us in Bethlehem.
Whoa.
He finally, you know, through his connections, he finally got us to a Franciscan retreat center, which was a great location. Actually, it was, you know, adjacent to the Church of the Nativity. But they opened just for us.
Really?
And this was a recurring theme. The hotel we stayed at in Jerusalem was closed because tourism, there are no tourists. And so the economic deprivation of that city, Jerusalem Bethlehem in particular, but we also saw it in Jerusalem. I had a picture of the Nablus Gate in the old city of Jerusalem, and I was showing it to some of my friends who know Jerusalem really well, and they said, That's the Damascus Gate. That's Nablus Gate. And I said, yeah. I said, well, what time was it? And I said, I don't know, like 4 p.m. or something. And they go, oh my God, there's nobody there. Like, you say this place is crowded and bustling. And and it's just not there. And I think this, you know, this is a combination of, I mean, they're still recovering from COVID. Okay. That was a big hit.
Wow.
But of course, it's also a reaction to October 7th. That has shut down a lot of things. And then of course, this recent war with Iran. Also is really discouraging people to go. We had people who were signed up to go to our trip who said, I don't feel comfortable going. Now, we never experienced anything. We felt perfectly safe the whole time we were there. We should encourage people to go. It's not an impossible trip. And it's certainly eye-opening and interesting and fascinating in, you know, 1,000 different ways. But that economic strangulation is making life so miserable that people are leaving.
Yes.
And it's the self-deportation in the same way that our country wants self-deportation as a way to solve what we call our immigration problem. Yes. They can self-deport, then everything's okay. Like, then we don't have to engage in violence. We don't have to engage in illegal activities or, you know, different illegal tactics in order to remove people from the country that we think shouldn't be here.
Right.
Instead, the work's done for us. Well, part of the Israeli strategy is to get as many Palestinians to deport as possible, especially Christian Palestinians.
Really?
Yeah, because Christians are in some ways more likely to be middle class, and they're more likely to have Western sympathy, whereas Arabs may be all considered terrorists, and therefore we're not going to, you know. So that's a little bit of it, but it's a deliberate strategy. And so while the Israelis are encouraging tourism, as any country does, their tourism never includes the West Bank. And when it does, particularly for Christian tourists who go to Israel and may want to go to see where Jesus was born in Bethlehem, they have buses that go directly in and directly out. They never stopped into any of the hotels or the restaurants or any of the shops.
So it's, when your group went there, were there attempts to enable and nurture better relations between Jewish and Arab / Muslim populations?
Well, we certainly learned about those efforts. My sense is that those have been seriously undermined by October 7th. And in the aftermath of October 7th, it's become increasingly hard. Let me give one example. We had a chance to meet with some members of what's called the Bereaved Parents Circle. And so we met with a man whose daughter had been killed in a Hamas bombing in the, I think, mid-1990s. And he was a very active member, Israeli man, very active member of this Bereaved Parent Circles. And then also a Palestinian father and his wife, whose daughter had been killed at a checkpoint. Wow. Where there was just some confusion had gone on, and the Israeli soldier just strafed the car, and they were badly injured, all went to the hospital, and then when they, you know, were finally conscious and of what happened, they learned that their daughter had been killed in that shooting. Mm. So here you have these two, and they're working together to go, we got to stop this. Like, yes, this senseless violence just has to end. And so they said they used to do trips all the time to high schools, both in the West Bank and in Israel, to sort of help explain a different way. They can't do that anymore.
Really?
They're not invited anymore. I think high school officials are too afraid of this. I mean, it's just, you know, it's so polarized and so intense. And again, after October 7th, all of that has just been ratcheted up. So I think a lot of those efforts are diminished. I think some of the really strong Israeli human rights groups that were very strongly supporting Palestinian human rights, they're not as vocal as they used to be.
Intimidation?
I think public opinion has shifted dramatically anti-Palestinian in the past couple, in the past 3 years, and perhaps even encouragement at what had happened in Gaza as a result of that.
Yes.
So, you know, we're looking at obviously the horrendous things that happened on October 7th, but then this way overreaction and what, you know, international legal agencies are calling a genocide in Gaza. So it's sort of like nobody wants to hear about those things anymore. So they haven't died. They're still meeting. They're still going on. But I think they have to find a new foothold. And things are looking so bleak now that I think that's one place where it's not always happening.
What are the, as an American, as you know, us Westerners, as people, us who consume mainstream media, et cetera, here, what are the main, maybe the top three delusions that we over here have that kind of clash with the reality of what's happening?
I think it's the way the war is framed. And you hear this all the time in the news media. You know, the Hamas war, the war with Hamas, the Israeli-Palestine war or struggle or violence or issue, sometimes very anodynely mentioned. It's just the wrong frame. And so the counter frame, which I learned very clearly, and I would say all of the people we spoke to, Israeli and Palestinian alike, all use the same terminology, and that's settler colonialism.
Wow.
If you don't understand settler colonialism, you don't understand what's happening as a consequence of settler colonialism, you really miss the main point. And so as an example of what that looks like is like I was just listening to a podcast a couple days ago, and they were talking about this sort of increasing numbers of Democrats have an unfavorable view of Israel. I think it's up to 70% now. And that's really grown just in the last 5 or 10 years, you know, especially since all of the horrific stuff that happened in Gaza. And so a lot of the blame and focus gets put on Netanyahu. It's like, well, Netanyahu is you know, a right-wing fanatic. Once we get rid of him, then it's sort of like, then we can return to the way things were before. But that the settler colonialism narrative says no, because what was happening before was settler colonialism, and that's at the root of the problem. And until we stop the colonization of where Palestinians have lived and where they continue to live, then we're not really going to get to this. And I think there's a lot of Israeli commentators, a lot of people who reject this idea of settler colonialism. Like, we're not colonists, you know. This was our land originally, and some of them will go back to, you know, biblical times that God gave them this land. But I was shocked to read in another great book, if I can recommend another book. It's starting to sound like Ezra Klein show, isn't it? So if I can recommend another book, it's called 100 Years War on Palestine by Rashid Khalidi. And he talks about his a relative of his who was mayor of Jerusalem in the early part of the 20th century, so like 1900s, 1910s, and he has this letter exchange with Theodor Herzl, who's the founder of Zionism. And Theodor Herzl, in his letters to them, uses the word colonize and colonialism. Like it sort of reminded me of people who were trying to pose the Civil War as like a noble struggle or a struggle against for states' rights.
Yes,
and it's like, no, it really had a lot to do with slavery, and then when people then then you say, if you read the Constitution of the Confederacy, it says our purpose is to maintain slavery. So it's like, you can't say it's not that if the founding documents say something else. And I would say, if you go back to some of the founding documents, you will see that that understanding this is a colonial task, that Zionism was a colonial task, understanding that, if you don't understand that, then everything else starts to look. And therefore, the consequence of that for today is everyone had the same thing. Nothing will change in the Middle East until we stop the occupation, until the Israelis take their foot off the neck of Palestinians who are currently trying to survive and live, instead of every single way they are to drive them out and to shrink the amount of land that they live on. And that's the reality we saw, was that shrinking land mass,
the ratchet only goes one way too,
right? Exactly. So you go a little further, and then when it comes back, it doesn't go all the way back. It catches on that next cog, and so maybe this is a good time to talk a little bit about the A, B, and C zones.
Sure.
Because I think this is – so when the Oslo Accords were signed, this is in the early 1990s, they had an interim solution to a transition into a Palestinian state.
Right.
And what it did is it took the West Bank. So this is – the West Bank was occupied territory, originally part of Jordan, but the Israelis took it over in the 67 war and never gave it back. And so part of the UN resolutions is you got to give that land back because you occupied it illegally. Well, that never changed. They didn't give it back.
That's right.
They held on to it. And so – they partitioned the West Bank into three different zones: Zone A, Zone B, and Zone C. Zone A was under the supervision and management of the Palestinian Authority, and that was sort of this interim body that could morph into a real
governor.
Right, a real state, a former actual nation. And then there were B territories, and those were controlled by the Israelis. And then there was C territory, which was jointly controlled, and mainly because they were not heavily populated and not and sort of represented some unique challenges, so that whatever issue came up, they would be jointly settled. So the Israelis theoretically wouldn't mess with Zone A, the Palestinians wouldn't mess with Zone B, and C is. Those boundaries that were formed in 1990, so this is almost 35 years ago, 36 years ago, haven't changed.
Wow.
In fact, if anything, the A zones have gotten condensed and they're smaller. And so we were frequently going between these different zones. We were frequently going between these different zones as we were traveling around the West Bank. And there's always a checkpoint if you go from one zone to the other. And Israelis are not allowed to go into Zone A.
Really?
It's illegal for them to do that.
Why?
Well, the Israelis say it's because they can't guarantee their safety. And so they just don't. It's like, just stay out of there and then we don't have to worry about your safety. But of course, that starts to look more and more like an apartheid system, which is why even Jimmy Carter called Israeli an apartheid state. So,
and they don't want to nurture any sort of cross-pollination of socialization ideas.
Right. Then you don't have a colonial problem. Or if they reassert themselves with some kind of cultural or identity, we're going to take them out of their school, out of that.
That's right.
And then reschool them in a Western so that they don't become a problem. And so I think we succeeded because we were able to kill enough Indians. I mean, not to put it in really raw terms, but you know, those numbers are awful, as I think Cornel West was trying to say. Well, if you look at Israeli behavior, really since the 1930s, particularly Zionist religion, Zionist Israeli behavior. It's all about genocide, ethnic cleansing, removal, and that doesn't make any sense at all until you think about it as settler colonialism.
Right.
Because Herzl said, we will not be able to form a Jewish nation in Palestine until we remove the Palestinians. He said that. And here we are, almost 150 years later,
right,
and they're still trying to remove all the Palestinians.
Jazz artists in residence going around the country and talking about the music, the culture, and all that. And what you just described reminded me of when we went to Browning, Montana. I spent a lot of time, one of my residencies was for the university in Missoula. And so we got to go to the Blackfoot Reservation, the Rocky Boy Reservations in Montana, which completely describe what you're talking about and the dispiritedness of the people, which was so intentionally pushed upon them. That was the whole idea. Now, it's funny because the kids, we were, again, working with high school, middle and high school age kids on the reservation, and they were so adept at being themselves and continuing to keep their spirit alive. And, well, anyway, that takes me, the question I was going to ask, what actions that we do here, what kind of effects are they having over there? And you've kind of answered that, really.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're certainly funding and supporting, providing not only military support, but I think perhaps even more important, particularly at the UN level, but certainly internationally, we're giving cover for all of this kind of this war crimes and apartheid and genocide and ethnic yes. cleansing and all of these sorts of terms, we're giving cover to that and legitimacy to that. And so when Israeli claims, well, we have to do these things out of a sense of safety and security. And of course, I challenge anyone to say, are the Israelis safer now than they were 3 years ago or 10 years ago? We're enabling all of this stuff to happen. And if I can just...
Sure.
Last fall, right after I got back from South Africa, some Palestinian Christians wrote something called Kairos Palestine 2. Now, there was a South African Kairos document, very famous, came out in 1985, and it was really saying, what is the challenge of apartheid to the churches of South Africa and to the churches around the world? And it lays it all out in very compelling language. And the idea of kairos is a Greek word for time. And there are two Greek words for time, one chronos, the other kairos. Chronos, of course, we talk about time, time passing, right? You know, some people talk about watches as,
chronometers.
What?
Chronographs.
Yeah. Or
chronometer.
Chronometer. That's the word I was looking for. The time is at hand. That is kairos in the original Greek. And so these were like, what is the current moment telling us? And so they wrote, Palestinians inspired by what the South Africans did in 2009 wrote a Kairos Palestine document in which they talked about what is our situation? You know, who is God now and what is God calling us to do? Well, in the face of what's happened in Gaza since October 7th, they felt they needed a second document, a Kairos 2 document. And so that's what this document is. So I'm going to tell you what they think North Americans should do.
Yeah.
And they have a particular focus because they're Christians. They have a particular focus on Christians and what the international church should do. And I'll just list a couple of of some of the things that they call for in this document. So we call for a global theological movement built on the pillars of God's kingdom, one that arises from the context and struggles of people suffering from colonialism, racism, apartheid, and structural poverty produced by corrupt economic and political systems that serve the interests of the world's empires. That's the frame they're providing. And then it goes on to say, and I think this is important to add, we condemn all who exploit and support the charge of anti-Semitism to silence Palestinian voice of truth. We reject every attempt to conflate anti-Semitism with opposition to apartheid and with pressure to hold Israel accountable under international law. We repeat and emphasize our appeal to the churches of the world, working together with both religious and secular coalitions, to pressure the governments to isolate Israel, hold it accountable, impose sanctions, boycott it, and to ban the export of arms until it complies with international law, ends oppression and tyranny, and adheres to the principles of justice and peace. Likewise, call upon the governments of the world to press for the prosecution of war criminals, whoever they may be, under the jurisdiction of the International Court of Justice and the International Criminal Court, to ensure reparations for the Palestinian people, both in their homeland and in the diaspora, and to work for the immediate return of the displaced through the reconstruction of Gaza and the strengthening of its people's steadfastness.
Wow.
I mean, think about it. This is Palestinian Christians writing this. And why this wasn't front page news for maybe now 7-8 months ago, I think is probably tells you everything you need to know about why we're in this current state, because nobody wants to look at it in this way. But I recommend, I mean, you can find this document online. Maybe we could attach it to,
and
we can put it in the show notes, but
sure.
It's called Kairos Palestine, the Palestinian Christian Initiative, a moment of truth, faith in a time of genocide. And I think, one of the things I've been thinking about is a couple years ago, I'm going to say maybe 5 years ago, the Iowa legislature passed an anti-BDS law. And BDS stands, of course, for boycott, divestiture, and sanctions. And so it made it illegal to call for those. And so to me, this is a violation of First Amendment rights, I would say. But that passed with support from Democrats and from Republicans. I think it's time, especially given everything that's happened since October 7th, to really revisit that and to go, what our Christian sisters and brothers are telling us in Palestine, the legislature has made illegal to do. Yes. And so I'm saying the legislature is standing in the way of us fulfilling, at least for me as a Christian, fulfilling my Christian obligation, which is to, you know, be my brother's keeper, take care and listen to what they're saying and try to be responsible to what they're asking of us.
What would you, coming back home, what do you want us to know?
Well, I think I've sort of boiled down my talking points because I'm trying to take very seriously Michael's call of go and tell. And so I have a number of speaking engagements. Uh-huh. I'm lining up more. I'm trying to get out and just to tell people, you know, what I did with you today, you know, what's going on? What did I experience? How do I understand the situation? So that's a big part of what I want to do. But I boil down my talking messages into, and I've hit them already, but I'll just reiterate them here. Number one, we have to look at the reframe as settler colonialism. Two, we have to understand the seriousness of the economic strangulation, and then the sort of the side of that same the opposite side of that same coin is travel, go see for yourself, make sure you get to the West Bank, visit visit Palestinians and talk to them and hear their, you know, hear their story. That that's all part of that economic strangulation message. And that may, and then the third one is let's continue to hold up and value the creativity behind Palestinian resistance, that they're not being crushed, you know?
Yes.
Not everybody's being crushed. There are people who are coming through. And if I could just give you another example of the incredible creativity. Some people may know this, some people may not. But one of the, there's two symbols of Palestine that you may not recognize. One is the poppy, and the other is a watermelon. And the and both of them have green, red, and black, which are, of course, the colors of the Palestinian flag. Well, the Palestinian flag was outlawed. In fact, I went to a bookstore in East Jerusalem where the Israelis invaded it, and they said they were selling and citing material because they had a Palestinian flag on the cover of one of the books. And so the owner was sent to jail, and I met him, I talked to him about his experience there, and they had to shut his store down for a while, and it's open now. I visited it. But that's how the Palestinian flag was an illegal thing to do. And so then they say, well, okay, we're going to have other symbols then. The watermelon, yes. The poppy. And so now you put the poppy up, the watermelon up, and everybody knows what it means. It's just like waving the Palestinian flag, but it's different. And so that's the kind of creativity that we just need to, I think, recognize it for what it is, recognize that that is what's keeping us from violence. Doesn't keep everyone, because other people don't have sufficient creativity to maintain that and feel like the only option they have is violence.
That speaks to the third question I'd ask back there. It seems to me people are suffering these immense hardships, physical and political. What keeps the people engaged? And there you go.
Yeah. And as somebody who wrote a book on creativity, one of the points I make in the book is that creativity is a life force. It is embedded in our very evolutionary DNA.
That's right.
And it allows us to move forward. Creativity and survival are intimately linked. And people get that. And so to me, what's really important, particularly as an observer, as somebody visiting, is where do I see that? Where do I see creativity in the resistance? And how can I hold that up? And how can it inform my form of resistance? Right. Because certainly there's lots of things going on that I want to resist. But how can we be creativity? And you and I are both longtime members of Iowa CCI. And if there's one thing that energizes me about Iowa CCI, it's the creativity of its resistance.
Amen. All righty. Well, for now, that's a good inflection point. Tom, thank you. Thank you. Thank you so very much for your time.
Thank you. Great questions and great conversation. I appreciate it.
I think it'll be continuing later on.
Okay.
Take care.
Bye.
Bye-bye now.